This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This week, Donald Trump became the first president of the United States to be impeached twice.
He must go. He is a clear and present danger to the nation that we all love.
They want to cancel the president.
Mr. Speaker, we are debating this historic measure at an actual crime scene.
I inform the House that Mr. Blumenauer will vote yes on H.R.S. 24. As the member designated by Mr. Liu pursuant to H.R.S. 8, I inform the House that Mr. Liu will vote yes on H.R.S. 24.
It's yet another unprecedented event in a presidency that has been absolutely full of them. But Trump's time is coming to an end, and he leaves to Joe Biden enormous challenges. The unending death toll of COVID-19 first and foremost, the economic crisis of the shutdown, the consequences of a four-year assault on democracy and the rule of law, and meanwhile, the Senate will be occupied with the first-ever impeachment trial of a former president. Susan Glasser is our Washington correspondent. Hi, Susan. How are you?
Hi, David. Thanks so much.
We're talking on Thursday morning, and you were inside the Capitol during the impeachment vote. Can you give us a sense of the mood in the building? What was it like all around in the lobbies and the foyers and all the rest?
Well, you know, David, for me, it was really unsettling and jarring. My first job out of college was working in Washington on Capitol Hill as a reporter for a roll call newspaper. And, you know, every time I went into that Capitol, it was a powerful experience. It is maybe not obvious to those who don't go in there all the time, but it is not just a historic building, but it's a gorgeous building whose very kind of majesty tends to inspire. And so after sort of spending a week absorbing the images of the rampaging mob to go in there, the thing that was really unsettling was it's now a fortress. It is now surrounded by an occupying army. There are tens of thousands of troops now in the Washington area, more than even there are U.S. troops in Afghanistan and Iraq combined at the moment. And you go inside the Capitol, and there are these National Guardsmen in fatigues toting long guns, assault weapons. It's very intimidating. But you go inside, and the thing that you notice is the silence and the uncanny emptiness of this place that's normally bustling with activity and tour groups and members of Congress to and fro and staffers and reporters. And it's this incredible open interplay, unlike the rest of Washington, which is generally very closed. So that's all gone, more or less.
Now, you spoke to Jeff Van Drew, who's a Republican from New Jersey. Let's play a clip from that.
So just on this day, do you believe now that Joe Biden was elected president of the United States legitimately?
Yes.
Do you believe that Americans should have faith in that process?
I think Americans are having a difficult time having faith in the process because we have altered it in so many ways and we're not listening or obeying the rule of law that we need to do.
Jeff Van Drew is a very interesting character because, first of all, he's this sort of very flamboyant figure, dressed up in this almost technicolor three-piece suit, having this conversation. He is the only Democrat who has the distinction of having switched parties to become a Republican because of his strong support for Donald Trump. To me, this was a sign, this conversation was an example of the incredible gap in not just our politics, but in the actual reality and the world that Republican members of Congress are living in versus the world that Democratic members of Congress are living in. And I was sort of having this back and forth with him, like, Congressman, well, first of all, I asked him, do you recognize Joe Biden's victory? Because people may not realize the vast majority of Republicans in Congress never acknowledged that Joe Biden won until after the storming of the Capitol, until after they voted. Many of them actually voted hours after the storming of the Capitol to continue to attack the Electoral College results and to therefore say that Biden is not a legitimately elected president.
I have to ask you, it seems like 15 years ago, but it's only a year ago that there was a first impeachment of Donald Trump, which you covered. Did the tone or the temperament of everyone in the building feel very different this time around, and how?
The short answer is both yes and no. And yes, in the sense that it was just a year ago, somebody said, well, I didn't realize that impeachment was about to become an annual national ritual. There's only been four impeachments of a president in history. Now, two of them have been of Donald Trump. So something that was incredibly rare has this bizarre feeling of now becoming almost a political commonplace, which is a striking development in and of itself. You know, Nancy Pelosi, who is very adept at the symbolism of politics, chose to wear the exact same outfit for this impeachment, knowing she would be very photographed, that she did for the first impeachment. And of course, that was immediately remarked upon. And I think the message is a very somber black dress. The message I got from that and from talking with Democratic members yesterday was sort of a combination of a deep and profound sadness that this is where we are, continuing alarm about the threats to the Capitol, but also the undercurrent here is, we told you so. We told you so. And of course, that's Adam Schiff's famous speech from the end of the first impeachment trial, which is, he's going to do it again.
He's going to do it again, and he will never change. And we're fools to think otherwise, right?
Yes, exactly. I've been thinking about that a lot, that speech, since the end of the election, actually, when it was clear that Donald Trump was going to do what no president in the United States has ever done and attack the legitimacy of the election and refuse to accept the outcome. That in and of itself was the unprecedented thing. But this crisis, therefore, has been going on ever since the election. I believe since literally that moment, I wrote a column for The New Yorker in the middle of the night, overnight of that election night that appeared on November 4th, saying Donald Trump may have lost, but he is still the president of Red America, and these people are going to follow him over the cliff of constitutional denialism. And it just didn't seem real to people, I think, until that horrible storming of the Capitol.
Now, not every congressman and congresswoman did follow him over the cliff in this second impeachment vote. 10 Republicans joined the vote to impeach. What political price will they pay, and why weren't there more of them?
Well, that is the question. I think that I understand there are two almost diametrically opposing ways of looking at this impeachment. One is, well, this was the most bipartisan impeachment ever. And it is true that this is the largest number of members of a party voting to impeach a president from their own party, 10. The previous record was 5 during Bill Clinton's impeachment in the Monica Lewinsky affair. But look, nearly 200 Republican members of Congress, 197 Republicans versus 10. So, I'm not that good at math, but even I can, look at that and say, I understand where the weight of the party is. So the biggest person to defect from Donald Trump, of course, in this vote was Liz Cheney, the number 3 ranking House Republican, the daughter of the former vice president. Cheney, for some time, has made it clear, especially since the election, that she was deeply uncomfortable with Trump's attacks on the institutions. So I wasn't surprised in a way. But of course, immediately there are calls for her to be removed from her leadership post. I think that will be an early sign of what happens. But the truth is that if you want to know how big is the institutionalist wing, the Republican establishment wing of the House GOP, the answer is it's almost infinitesimally small.
It's a mystery to me what Mitch McConnell actually wants. He has signaled to the press that he was fine with impeachment, which in stark contrast to the first time around. And yet it's not clear that he would vote to convict or whether he even has the influence to whip 17 votes in favor of conviction. What does he want to come out of this?
Look, I think he would want Donald Trump to be gone, banished, done, over as a factor in his party. I also think that Mitch McConnell is ultimately an institutionalist for whom Senate Majority Leader was always the highest calling. And Donald Trump just destroyed his Senate majority by his behavior in the Georgia Senate races and took away the only job that Mitch McConnell ever wanted. The reports are that Mitch McConnell is done and finished with Donald Trump. So, however, he can still count votes. And the bottom line is that the House Republicans, despite these signals emitting from McConnell world, did not go along with a breakout. So Mitch McConnell, I think, made a significant decision that he wasn't going to hold a Senate trial right away, but was going to wait until the Biden presidency.
Meanwhile, as they say in movies, Joe Biden will be president of the United States come next week, and he faces all the challenges that we know. Is there going to be a first priority, or does he have to do many things at once? What are you hearing from the Biden people?
You know, David, what's so remarkable about this transition and the fact that we're just days away from the inauguration of a new president, there's so much mayhem and chaos, it's been hard even to focus on it. And so his first priority in some ways is actually the more amorphous one that's the theme of his inauguration, American unity. And the question of can he at least appear to change the direction of our divided politics. The events of the last week made that much harder to do, it seems to me. In a specific sense, the pandemic, of course, is the top priority and will continue to be, I think, for many months into it. They've said that they will bring a new COVID relief package to the floor of the newly Democratic Senate as their first piece of business. Biden has already laid out in quite significant detail, some changes that he plans to make. But first of all, just having a national approach to the pandemic in and of itself is a change. Internationally, there is also a big agenda that will start on day one, including rejoining the Paris Climate Accords. There will be the question of what to do about Iran and the nuclear deal. Can it be returned to? There is an arms control treaty with Russia that expires in just a few weeks. So there's a huge agenda of announcing to the world that America is back in some significant way as a partner to its allies and also as an adversary to its adversaries again.
Susan Glasser has been writing our column, and brilliantly, I should say, Letter from Trump's Washington, and she's been doing it since 2017. And now, soon, she'll begin writing a column called Letter from Biden's Washington. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, David. The transition, I guess, in the column begins at 12:01 p.m. next week.
The threat of violence during the inauguration is hanging over the United States like some sort of ugly cloud. The FBI warns of armed protests in every state capital. In Washington, 20,000 National Guard troops will be deployed, as though we were at war somehow. American carnage, indeed.
When he said, "We're going to the Capitol," it was like the entire crowd had already been primed to know exactly what he meant and what they were going to the Capitol to do. That felt pretty clear to me.
Luke Mogelson has been reporting for The New Yorker about the right-wing uprising against the election. And he was at the Capitol during the riot, writing everything down and recording things with his phone.
As we approached the Capitol grounds, there were already violent confrontations between the riot police at the base of the Capitol steps and protesters who had arrived before Trump had even finished his speech. and they were deploying tear gas and pepper spray and flashbang grenades. But again, there were just too many Trump supporters, and they were determined to get through.
USA! USA! USA!
Copies out!
Now, you made your way into the Senate chamber.
We paid for it! This is our house!
What did you see and hear? What were these people saying? What did they want?
Well, it was extremely surreal.
They left in a hurry, look at this.
And it contrasted pretty starkly with the scene outside of the Capitol, because inside the Senate chamber, there were very few people and it was quiet. Once people were inside the Capitol, they were searching for lawmakers, members of Congress, senators, and after they realized that the lawmakers had already been evacuated from the building, they didn't really know what to do
But they were searching for them toward what end? Because we did hear reports of cries of, you know, hang Mike Pence and similarly disgusting things directed toward Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah. Nobody explicitly stated to me or to each other that I observed what their intent was, what they were going to do to the lawmakers if they found them. But it seemed pretty clear to me that their lives would have been in danger. That seems like a safe deduction to make.
I don't mean to make light of this at all, but in your description of things, not least in the Senate chamber, the people there seemed like lost souls. A guy sits down in the Senate chamber and he says, I've got to call my dad. And people taking selfies of themselves. There's a quality not only of rage, but in some circles of lostness, of something really both ugly but also colossally foolish.
Once they were inside the chamber, they really didn't know what to do with themselves. And they were making crass jokes, taking selfies.
Freedom! Freedom!
Rifling through the senators' desks, looking for incriminating documents, misunderstanding pretty much every document that they did come up on.
He was going to sell us out all along.
Really?
What? Objection to counting electoral votes of the state of Arizona.
Can I get a photo of that?
Wait, no, that's a good thing. Oh, no, that's actually okay. All right, we're done. I'm pissed.
He's with us.
Yeah, don't do that.
Most of the people that initially entered the Senate chamber left after 10 or 15 minutes because they got bored and didn't know what to do. One guy joked, we might as well set up a government while we're here. A couple people gave speeches from the vice president's chair.
As if they were in a school play or something. Horrific way.
It had that quality to it.
Unbelievable. Luke, it's hard to ask a reporter whose main job is to tell us what you see right there, and prediction is a low form of journalism, but is January 6th the end of this or the beginning of a chronic, frightening problem in American life when it comes to this kind of pro-Trump, America first, white nationalist, violent, potentially, movement?
I would guess the latter. I think that it would not be prudent to assume anything else or prepare for anything less. At the end of the night, after the National Guard had finally managed to expel the last of the rioters from inside the Capitol. Several mobs kind of shifted their attention to the broadcast journalists who had set up outside and chased them off, smashed their equipment. And at some point, everybody was standing around in an almost ritualistic type circle surrounding this heap of smashed camera equipment. And a man gave a speech to everybody telling them that this was the beginning of a new civil war and that they needed to go home, go storm their respective capitals, go hunt down the traitors, hunt down the enemies of the people, make lists, and kill them. Kill the traitors. And, you know, since Parler has been deplatformed and the FBI has launched this massive national investigation trying to identify and track down the people who participated in the attempted insurrection, a lot of them have gone to ground. But if anything, I think that the people we need to be most worried about were galvanized by January 6th, not humbled by it.
Remarkable. You can find Luke Mogelson's article, Among the Insurrectionists, at newyorker.com.